Hello, everybody, and all you ships at sea. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where we review movies for all the ships at sea. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs at sea.
Oceans are now battlefields. My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film, and we're going to review only a few movies.
At sea.
At sea.
We are reviewing...
Or on dry land, wherever you happen to be.
Dry land is real. I have seen it. We will be reviewing on this week's episode the new remake slash reboot of The Toxic Avenger. The new Darren Aronofsky joint Caught Stealing. The new comedy The Roses. And the Thursday Murder Club.
Yeah,
it sounds very intriguing when you put it like that.
Yeah, it's unfair. We murder on Thursdays. We're Thursday murder people.
Yeah,
it's not like Tuesdays with Maury. Murders with Tuesday.
Yeah. We murdered Maury.
Oh, is Murray the victim? And Tuesdays with Maury, but on Thursday we kill him.
Yeah. And good news, it wasn't Rappaport.
Oh my god. We're going way deep on the, like, our Tuesdays with Maury references. We just lost everybody, by the way. They're just tuned out.
To be fair, this episode did go live on a Tuesday.
Fair.
So it's fair game, baby. Yeah, we're reviewing those movies. And let's just get right into it. I think the biggest release of the weekend was, like, Weapons again or something. So we're going to talk about the movie that we're most excited about. A little movie. Quite a little movie. Called The Toxic Avenger. Now, Whitney.
Yeah.
What was your first exposure to The Toxic Avenger?
I actually didn't watch The Toxic Avenger until relatively recently.
Really? How recently are we talking?
Like, within the last year and a half or so. Yeah.
You love Scuzz!
I love Scuzz, and I've seen a lot of trauma movies, but like
their
crown jewel,
yeah,
The Toxic Avenger, has just skipped me by.
That's like saying I love superhero movies, but I've never heard of this Batman guy. Like, it just never come up.
So I've seen the Rabid Grannies, Killer Condom, which they just distributed.
Yeah.
Romeo and Juliet is a favorite. I've seen Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen these movies, but yeah, I just never actually sat. And I've seen. I've seen the Class of Nukem High 2 and 3, but never 1.
Ah, the good one. I worry sometimes that trauma is being left in the dust. Mm. And I feel like there was a period of about 20, 25 years where trauma was kind of the renegade movie studio. And if you just knew trauma...
Mm.
People knew you were cool.
Because you'd seen some trauma movies.
Yeah, like if you'd seen Sergeant Kabuki Man, everyone was just sort of like, tight.
Trauma, sadly, rose and fell with the popularity of video stores. Mm-hmm. That was sort of their stock and trade for many decades.
Mm-hmm.
They could churn out these things on the cheap if they were even the ones producing them. Mostly they would just wait for completed films and distribute them for other people.
Yeah, people who would like just make some horror movie in their backyard.
Like Cannibal the Musical is a trauma. Distributed by Trauma.
Yeah, the Horror of the Humongous Hungen is a funny title I whip out a lot, but that's a real movie. Trauma put it out. But yeah, basically, people would make these low-budget, mostly crappy horror movies. Occasionally a good one came out.
Mm.
And then Trauma would be the one studio that was like, we'll distribute that.
Yeah.
And then they would slap it on a box, and then not only would they ship it off to video stores, and in the early days of video stores, especially in the 1980s, they were just desperate for anything to put on the shelves because the studios were only kind of trickling it out. So people would go to the video store, they'd rent out all the big titles, but they still want to watch something on their cool new VHS. So, or VCR, I guess.
VCR,
they
wanted to rent something at the store.
Yeah. So we'll take what we can get. And Trauma filled that niche. And as a result, a lot of their movies got seen by a way bigger audience than they normally ever would have.
And Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz were the two sort of founders of Trauma. They're based in New Jersey. And they came up with this very Herschel Gordon Lewis-ish ethos to their distribution, mm-hmm. where they knew they could get renters if they put a really like eye-grabbing title on their video box.
Yeah, and, so, and also monsters, guns, and boobs. Like any of those, any combination of those things, you had a hit.
Yeah, one of their biggest early hits was called Stuck on You. It's a sex comedy. And I haven't seen the movie, but I remember the poster.
Sure.
It's two lovers chewing gum, and they're nude, and their bodies are stuck together in a way. You can't see the naughty bits. But that'll catch somebody's eye.
I got nothing else to do on a Friday.
And if you were in one a neighborhood that didn't have porn, or porn shops were kind of verboten.
Yeah, there were a lot of video stores that were in Christian neighborhoods. Yeah, like, didn't even want to have an adult section, but R rated.
You could have these kind of smutty sex comedies, and that was a good stand-in for pornography, and that was actually a good business for a long time. Sometimes they would just get interesting titles and distribute them. Teenage Cat Girls and Heat. That's going to catch your eye.
They were the first American distributor of My Neighbor Totoro. No one else was interested.
That's true.
Yeah, that's a real thing.
Troma did it. But yeah, they were this schlocky, scuzzy studio that did all these wonderfully low-budget movies.
And they sold themselves on that ethos.
Yeah, they knew they had trash, and they loved that they had trash.
Yeah.
And they made movies that were often really cheap looking. They knew they were cheap looking, and they kind of rolled with it.
Yeah.
And they just tried to put in a lot of gore and boobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in this very unapologetic way. If you look at the B movies of like Roger Corman, he was trying to make things that looked like real movies.
Yeah. He was trying to trick you.
He was making them on the cheap. He knew that they needed violence and sex and exploitation elements. But he also was trying to tell real stories and actually make real movies.
He didn't want to be unrespectable.
Yeah. Lloyd Kaufman didn't give a shit.
No.
He was very happy to be known as the trash guy.
Right.
He knew he was making trashy movies. He knew people were watching these things because they were trash. And he was just having a great time.
But I think it's worth noting, if you're not familiar with Troma, that you might be hearing all this and think, oh, these are sleazemongers. Mm. And yeah, they monged some sleaze, but they actually had a pretty good heart about it. Like, there was all in the name of good fun.
Yeah.
And a lot of their movies, even their ultra-violent movies with a lot of boobs and a lot of just cheap, tawdry, infantile humor, there was a sense of naivete that they presented them with. These were not cynical features. They were critical features, and they often took place in sort of a 1980s landscape that was like perverted by toxic waste dumping, and everything was kind of awful and gross, but there was always innocence within those worlds, and that violence and that sexuality and that really very dark humor that they often had was usually presented with you guys, it's cute. And they would have like shows and videos and do live appearances that were basically just inviting everyone into the Troma family. Lloyd Kaufman wrote two books. How to Make... What was it? Everything You Need to Know About Filmmaking, Learn from the Toxic Avenger.
Yeah.
And Make Your Own Damn Movie. I think James Gunn worked on one of those. And James Gunn got a start at Troma writing Tromeo and Juliet.
And it's been downhill ever since for James Gunn.
And I think that's fair to say. But
I haven't liked his movies as much since.
I know, you're very, very smart. Look, my point is this.
I am, aren't I?
Yes, I know.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Yeah, no, you're better than all of us. You absolute god of a man. No, but Lloyd Kaufman had a very anti-establishment kind of vibe. He just thought that the big studios were strangling out all of the originality, all of the independence. They were making it harder for anyone to get work, put out something interesting. And he didn't like the homogeneity of what the big studios were putting out. And he saw Troma as sort of intentionally putting a stiff middle finger in the face of all of that. And so to like Troma movies, and yeah, it's a little bit of a cult, they're cult movies, was to basically be part of a counterculture movement.
Yeah.
So to be a Troma fan at its best was a sense that you belonged to a group of people who liked scuzzy, weird shit when most of the people around you didn't. It was actual counterculture. But the thing about Troma is that even though it was counterculture, they still had a mascot. They had an actual franchise, bona fide franchise. They had a couple, but the big one was the Toxic Avenger.
Yeah, they made four of them.
Yes, they did. There was originally going to be three, but the second one ended up being so long they just split it into two movies. But the Toxic Avenger came out in the early 1980s, and it was a monster superhero movie. It was really ahead of the game in that regard. People really weren't making superhero movies like that at the time. And it was about a dweeby nerd who, like the protagonists or the monster in many a 1980s movie, was initially the victim of a horrible prank. And he ended up not only humiliated in front of everybody wearing a tutu, he was also splattered with toxic waste, like that one guy in RoboCop. Mm. But the toxic waste, much like many Marvel heroes, ended up giving him superpowers. His superpowers were he was incredibly strong, he was incredibly invulnerable, and whenever he was in the presence of evil, he flew into a homicidal rage. So if there were evil people around, he had an uncontrollable compulsion to kill them. But they were always cartoonishly evil. There was never any question.
No.
They're always monstrous human beings.
These are, in case it doesn't, this needs saying, these were very broad pictures.
Yes.
They had almost a Police Academy vibe to them. Yeah. They were slapstick comedies just as much as they were monster movies.
Yeah, it's hard to take him seriously, although I think the Toxic Avenger himself was very sympathetic. Mm. Toxie was a hit. People liked Toxie. He made appearances at all of their live shows. Mm. He ended up starring in four movies.
Was at a lot of like horror cons and that kind of stuff.
He probably still goes. Mm. He used to be at Comic Con every single year. I've had a couple DVDs signed by him.
I ran into him on Halloween on the West Hollywood Parade.
Oh, that's nice.
He was down there like filming people. And
that's
cool. And I saw him. I was like, that's Lloyd Kaufman. What's he doing here in California? I thought he lived in New Jersey. Yeah. And he's like filming some friends.
Yeah.
I just walked past and I just shouted, "Hey, Lloyd, I love your movies." And without even looking up from his camera, he just shouted, "And they love you, baby."
That's very Lloyd. Lloyd,
that's my Lloyd Kaufman story.
Lloyd Kaufman is like a used car salesman if he was a director. He's got a very just always on, always selling kind of vibe. But the Toxic Avenger was very, very popular. The Toxic Avenger was so popular, he had a cartoon series.
Yeah.
On like, and not like an adult one like Duckman. No. A kid's cartoon series called Toxic Crusaders. There were action figures. I owned one.
You had a Toxic Avenger?
I think I did, yeah.
All right.
I'm trying to remember. Well, now you got me questioning it. Hmm. But
I knew there were toys, but
yeah.
That's cool.
No, it's very, very cool. So he was like this weird crossover hit. There was that weird time in the 90s where like R-rated movies could have like Saturday morning cartoon shows.
RoboCop, Rambo, Police Academy. Again,
Tales from the Crypt. Odd.
Mm-hmm.
Odd that we did that, but by God.
Well, just those films were having penetration to a kid audience.
I was just reading somewhere about apparently in like 1990, 1991, Julia Roberts won a Kids' Choice Award for Pretty Woman. We were just allowed to see anything. Normally, that would not be considered a kids' movie nowadays. But at the time, Toxic Avenger is very, very popular. Toxic Avenger is a beloved character. I remember the first time I ran into the Toxic Avenger, it was on one of the greatest shows ever to air on television, USA Up All Night. USA Up All Night was on the USA Network. It would air like after midnight. Gilbert Gottfried or someone similar would be like out on the town at various bars that were open super late. And he'd just be hosting interstitials. And occasionally they'd cut back to the Toxic Avenger or that one weird sex comedy where a kid finds a leprechaun in a beer bottle and it gives him sexy wishes.
What?
I cannot remember for the...
You're making stuff up.
That's a real movie. I cannot remember the title of that movie for the life of me. I think I looked it up once and I was like, oh, that's what it was called. And then I completely forgot it.
Leprechaun?
The leprechaun is not sexy. The leprechaun grants sexy wishes. Just so we're clear. He's at the bottom of a beer bottle. This would have been a sex comedy of the 1970s at the earliest, but probably 1980s, maybe 1990.
1989.
Mm-hmm.
The title is, fittingly enough, Getting Lucky.
That sounds right.
Nerdy student's life changes after encountering mischievous leprechaun. It's a trauma film.
Yep, that's 100% correct. Yeah. But USA Up All Night, even though it was basic cable, because it was on super duper late, they just left shit in. And the first time I saw the Toxic Avenger, some guys were like, I think they were like holding up like a restaurant or something, and the Toxic Avenger bursts in, and everyone's like, "Hey, it's a Toxic Avenger!" And then the Toxic Avenger punched through a guy's stomach, ripped out his small intestine, and jumped rope with it.
Yeah, sounds about right.
That's a Toxic Avenger. Yeah. They've been talking about doing a remake of the Toxic Avenger for a while, like in like a sort of a bigger budget Hollywood mold. Arnold Schwarzenegger was attached for a while. I don't know if he was going to be Toxie or the villain or what, but that would have been an interesting version. Instead, we waited a very long time, and we got a remake slash reboot from Macon Blair, who's probably best known as an actor. You might remember him. You might remember him from Blue Ruin.
He did. Well, he was in Blue Ruin. He directed Green Room.
No. That was Jeremy Saulnier.
Or was he in Green Room?
He's in Green Room. Right. He directed... oh God, what was it? Something. I'm getting tired of the end of the world or something like that. What the hell was that called?
We are the people who live in the castle.
No, that's Shirley Jackson.
One of those.
It was a long title. It wasn't. Yeah. I don't feel at home in this world anymore. Or maybe it was.
I think that's it. Actually,
yeah.
I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Well, good for him. So, yeah, I don't feel at home in this world anymore. Okay. He directed it. Peter Dinklage stars in it, and he is the Toxic Avenger. Great get.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Bacon plays the villain. Great get.
Casting Peter Dinklage as the Toxic Avenger is a stroke of genius.
Mm-hmm.
Because Peter Dinklage is too good an actor to let this slide as something... 100% cheeky. Yeah. He knows it's cheeky.
Yeah.
He knows how to play the part funny.
Mm-hmm.
But he also knows that the character is really pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And he spends the first half of the movie just sort of wallowing in his own self-pity.
Yeah, the idea is that he is just a put-upon nice guy who doesn't deserve how much shit the world has heaped on him. So when he becomes a Toxic Avenger and gets to, like, rip a guy's jaw out, you're like, good for you.
Yeah.
It doesn't... Because if he was, like, just a normal guy and he suddenly started murdering people, you'd be like, nah, you might be a dick. Like, no, when Peter Dinklage does it, by the time he does it, it's like, fair game. 100%.
Now we're remaking a trauma film. And this is going to be a delicate balance because trauma, a lot of trauma's strength came from the fact that it was super cheap. And... through that cheapness, you could sense a great, we were just talking about it, this great earnestness from the filmmakers.
Yeah.
They had a need to entertain. They knew it was cheap. They knew it was low. But we're all here for the same reason.
No, and they put a lot of effort into its cheapness.
Yeah.
Like, these weren't like little things we shot in our backyard. They would go out on the streets of New York. One time they jumped a car off of something. But, you know, it was so fucking dangerous they never did it again. And then they reused that car shot in every movie they ever did afterwards. Because we're never doing that again. And that was good production value.
So if you're going to do that with a bigger budget, what are you left with? You're nothing, really.
Yeah.
You're trying to emulate cheap earnestness when you need studio oversight. And that doesn't happen.
No.
It has to be done on the cheap. And it's... And I see this happen time and time again, even with low-budget movies, where they try to recapture that earnest sense of humor to entertain and end up pushing it into this self-aware, ironic realm that robs it of its power.
No. It's very, very tricky to... Because here's the thing. The new Toxic Avenger, it's clearly more expensive than the original Toxic Avenger movies. It's still pretty damn cheap.
Yeah.
Like, but they threw their money in at a few visual effects and the makeup, and they tried to make sure, you know, it looked respectable and they could sell it in a theater. It ended up playing at a festival and then went unreleased for 2 years because people didn't think anyone would buy it. Shame. It's a delight. But Macon Blair gets it, and this is something I was really struck by in his Toxic Avenger, because he understands that trauma isn't just the character of Toxie. It isn't just violence. It isn't even just naivete. It is an aesthetic. Like, the two things that I noticed that he made sure to put throughout the movie that I think other maybe lesser filmmakers or filmmakers who weren't on the right wavelength, at least, would have missed were things that you'd see in every trauma movie. One, everything is unnecessarily gross. Like, you can't pour orange juice into a glass without spilling it anywhere, and then nobody picks it up. Everything in this universe is unnecessarily untidy. That creates a vibe.
It's untidy. It's messy. It's cruel. A big part of the appeal of the original Toxic, because if you look back to sort of the mid 1980s, there was like the Bhopal disaster, and there was a lot of the Chernobyl disaster.
Love Canal.
All of these horrible environmental disasters were coming out with toxic waste and radiation,
pesticides.
All of this was coming out at the same time, and filmmakers decided to kind of make light of that. Mm-hmm. And they were doing it for decades. Like, we talked about The Oblongs, an animated series from like the early 2000s on our Cancel Too Soon podcast. Mm-hmm. That was about a rich neighborhood that was pouring toxic waste into a lower neighborhood. And it was about the people who lived in that in the lower neighborhood and the health problems they were dealing with. All of that was sort of grist for the mill in 1984 when the original Toxic Avenger came out. Mm-hmm. We didn't fix it. We have the same problems.
Yeah.
So making the Toxic Avenger in 2025 is still weirdly appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Totally fair game.
However, now we have to sort of just expand that into the whole universe. Everything is run by an evil, greedy pharmaceutical corporation that is the one doing all of the polluting. Everybody's corrupt. Everybody's being bribed, and they have secret labs. And in a weird way, it's believable within the structure of this universe.
And it's believable in the structure of our universe. Yeah. The other thing that Macon Blair does that I thought was like, it's so hard to understand how Troma does this, because it looks like a cinematic Band-Aid, and indeed it is, but they elevated it to an art form. The superfluous ADR.
Oh, just like the jokes thrown in on the side?
Well, it's not even jokes half the time. ADR, automatic dialogue replacement, is where after the movie is completed, you have people record dialogue in a booth somewhere. Sometimes this is because the sound was unusable and you needed to re-record a line. But often it's there to just sort of throw in a little bit of exposition.
Yeah.
You know, like you cut out a scene that clarified that people are going somewhere, and now in the exterior of a car driving up, they say, "Oh, I'm so glad we decided to go to this chemical plant and look for clues." Like just boom, voiceover, you're good. Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Hirst, they were so concerned that people wouldn't be following along with their narrative that people would often just yell things.
Mm.
And they thought that they could get away with it if they just sort of yelled out plots sometimes. So like there's, or just excuses. There's a scene in the movie Terror Firmer where a guy was electrocuted to death.
Mm.
And then after he's electrocuted to death, his hair goes all spiky, like a cartoon.
Yeah.
Problem was, before that, the actor was bald.
Oh.
The actor was bald, and then all of a sudden, for the electrocution effect, they put a wig on him, and they kind of forgot that that wouldn't make sense, so they added an ADR, just someone yelling, "He's got an afro now!" Like, that's it.
That's and hilarious.
Here, at the beginning of this movie, Peter Dinklage, sees like a mob goon trying to like talk his neighbor into selling her land, and he's got like her cat with him, and he's like, "Oh, it's okay, I'll take very good care of your cat," and then he drops the cat in the street in traffic, and Peter Dinklage runs into traffic and saves the cat, and then someone yells off screen, "He saved a cat!" Just in case that was too subtle.
I assumed that was a reference to the book Save the Cat.
It is a reference to Save the Cat, but just in case you didn't get that, we yelled it.
Yeah.
And it's full of unnecessary exposition like that, and it's genuinely funny. Mm. He clearly totally gets it. The plot of the movie is he's in trouble. He's a single father. Jacob Tremblay plays his son.
Single stepfather.
Apologies. Mm. He's barely making it work, and then he finds out that because of the chemical plant he works at, he has brain cancer and he only has a year to live. And of course, his health insurance is impenetrable. So he goes to his boss, played by Kevin Bacon, to beg him to help him with his health insurance.
Kevin Bacon, who plays a lot of heavies like this.
He does this a lot lately. Yeah. I think ever since Super, it's been kind of his shtick.
Yeah.
He's good at it. Of course, he doesn't help. Peter Dinklage decides to break into the chemical plant right when another woman is trying to break in to like steal corporate secrets to expose them. And that's when evil Elijah Wood sicks his monster core rock band assassins on them, and it all goes wrong.
And they're called like the Hot Nuts,
the Stinky Nuts, something like that. There's a scene where Elijah Wood just speaks into like the Siri on his phone, "Siri, release the nuts. Bless him. He knows what movie he's in. He's having a great time.
He could produce this. He's into this kind of
B-movies. I think he did
produce
it. Yeah. I want to give credit where credit is due. We talked about Peter Dinklage, who is extremely funny in this, especially after the Toxic Avenger. His dialogue performance is really just kind of like mildly embarrassed by the horror he hath wrought.
Yeah.
But he is not the only person giving this performance. Like Darth Vader before him, in the costume, it's not him. I don't know if it was an availability thing or what. Maybe they could only afford Peter Dinklage for so long. The Toxic Avenger apparently studied Peter Dinklage's movements. Like, he recorded all the movements.
Mm.
And then they studied it, and then they copied them in the suit. They're played by Luisa Guerrero, who has a very long career. She was on Teletubbies. She's a character in the new Baldur's Gate. Mm. You recognize her from things, even if you don't recognize her. And she's really funny. Like, everyone's really giving their all to this thing. It's super violent. It's very pointed in that very direct, unflinching trauma way. Did you know big corporations are bad? They're not wrong.
It's worth repeating.
It's important to keep that in the public eye. We lose sight of it sometimes. Mm. And that's the movie, really. At one point, he like finds out his urine is corrosive and uses it to like melt through chains. Bless him. It's exactly what you're supposed to do when you're a Toxic Avenger.
And it's not shy about the gore. There's a scene where somebody gets their intestines pulled out of their own butt or shoved back in their butt.
I think they were pulled out of their own butt.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, no, wait. They were pulled out of his gut and then shoved up his butt.
Yeah. Like you do.
Creative, you know? They're trying to do something. There's
I've never done that.
I've never seen that in a movie before.
Yeah.
There's a kind of wild joy to this Toxic Avenger that is lacking from a lot of these neo grindhouse movies. This could have been awful. And I've seen a lot of films try to do something like this and fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because, and I've said this before, I think when filmmakers understand that something is outrageous, they kind of push it and then they kind of immediately swivel their head around to the audience and, you know, rib us with their elbows saying, hey, isn't that outrageous?
Yeah.
And I can say, yes, it is. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
And the filmmakers clearly have no viewpoint. They're clearly just trying to push some kind of envelope in their own heads.
Yeah. The outrageousness is not an extension of their own sense of taste.
Yeah.
It's an extension of what they think the audience would be into.
When I see something really wild and gross and gory, I don't want to be ribbed and have the filmmaker say, isn't that outrageous? I want them to say, that's fun.
Yeah.
We're having fun. We like this.
Isn't this cool? Mm. What? I can't believe we're getting away with this. We get to do this for a living. This is awesome.
And I feel like that's what the makers of this new Toxic Avenger have. This feels like it feels like a Madballs movie.
Ooh,
if you remember the Madballs, they were toys from the 80s, like really gross toys were, I think they're still a thing for young kids.
But they were really huge hit in the 80s. We had the Garbage Pail Kids, Boglins.
Yeah, these like
Toxic Crusaders. It was the early 90s, but still.
The idea is, you know, gross, boogery stuff and, you know, snot and vomit. Like, we're
creepy
really big.
Creepy crawlers.
Yeah, bugs and snakes. And these were just toys for kids. It understood that kids like gross stuff.
Yeah.
And they marketed these mad balls, these grotesque severed heads.
Well, they were foam balls, but they looked like monster heads. So, like, this one is like a floating mummy head, and this one is a cyclops.
This one's just like a severed eyeball. Yeah, and
this one has like a hand on it, like a severed hand carrying an eyeball.
And they were like beaten up, and they had scars and pus, and they had broken teeth.
I had mad balls. And they were great.
I love those mad balls when I was a kid.
Sadly, they were not made to last.
No, they're foam rubber. If you have one, they've probably broken down by now and just rotted
away.
Damn shame. But, It's this sort of sensibility that kids love gross stuff. Grown-ups love gross stuff, too. I like to watch gross movies.
Yeah.
And this is a movie made by people who like gross stuff. But in that weird, childish, vomitorium kind of a way.
Well, it's an innocent way. They're not doing this because they hate people. They're doing this because they love people.
Yeah. And they're using the power of disgust to stick it to the man.
Yeah.
And that I appreciate. There's a weird righteousness to this movie, despite how gross it is. the Toxic Avenger robs, or I guess before he mutates, when he's still Peter Dinklage, is robbing a safe at one point, and he soaks his mop in some kind of corrosive chemical, and that becomes his weapon for the rest of the movie.
That's his Excalibur.
Yeah, it's just, which is also taken from the original. He has a mop. That's his weapon.
I think the mop was just a mop originally, though.
It was just a mop originally. In this one, it's, yeah, soaked in chemicals in a way that turned it into this eternally smoking torch-like thing that he can just swipe through people and take their heads
off. It's his Mjolnir. It's just his magic weapon. It's cool.
Okay, let's use toxic slime.
Do it.
To stick it to the polluters. It's
Captain Planet would be proud.
Yeah.
Maybe wouldn't approve of the rating, but otherwise he's thinking your heart's in the right place. And their heart is in the wrong place. It shouldn't be over there. It should probably be in their chest cavity.
No, it's grossness to be moral.
Yeah.
Grossness and the power of morality. And I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think of the Mad Balls, because the kids collected those things specifically so they could piss off adults.
Mm-hmm.
I want the gross toy because it grosses you out, Mom and Dad.
Yeah.
And I think it's fun, and fuck you.
That was the whole
kids
pitch.
Your kids rule, adults drool.
Yeah, your parents won't like this. And I'm like, your parents had to buy it for you. Mm-hmm. There's no way you had that money. Not in the 80s.
Are kids going to buy this for their kids? Are adults going to buy this for their kids? Yeah, the kids are going to bug them about it.
Yeah. Can we have a Mad Balls, Dad? Can we have a Mad Balls,
and
Dad?
I know we have a whole movie where I really hope there's some enterprising 13-year-old out there who is begging their parents to go see the Toxic Avenger, and that the mm-hmm. parents are going to be totally grossed out.
Yeah.
Completely uncool about it.
Yeah.
But the kids are going to grow up cool because they're going to see this thing.
I think
it's okay for... It's an R-rated film. It's really gory. Mm. There's not a lot of sex in the movie.
No, there's almost none to speak of.
But yeah.
I'm trying to even think.
The gore is plenty spectacular, though.
Yeah, the gore is gross, but again, it's all in the spirit of good fun. I feel like, you know, much as like a 11, 12-year-old version of me saw the Toxic Avenger 2 on USA Up All Night... Mm. Some youngsters are going to be like, are going to find this movie on streaming, and when their parents aren't watching, they're going to watch it and go, oh, we're going to make movies. And we're going to do it by hand, motherfuckers, the real way, the trauma way, not the AI way.
We're going to hire Elijah Wood and dress him like Riff Raff.
And
from
he
Rocky
will
Horror.
Do it.
Yeah, yeah.
He will happily. You try keeping him away from that production.
And I appreciate that everybody's there for. Who's the. Who's the freedom fighter character?
Oh, Taylor Page.
Taylor Page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's fully committed.
Yeah, she's playing the part. You hire Kevin Bacon as a heavy. Like I said, he's played a lot of heavies like this, but he's never sleepwalking. He's always selling it. He always knows how to play a character like this. Peter Dinklage is really, really committed. And and what was her name? Luisa Guerrero?
Luisa Guerrero
is doing all the fight scenes and growling and doing
she's
all those wonderful
it. She's
things.
Great.
They're making a real movie.
Yeah.
And just it has a scene where a guy gets his guts shoved up his own butt.
They made their own damn movie and they learned everything they needed to know from the Toxic Avenger. Perfect.
And it has this, it is that same anti-corporate 80s punk rock themes to it, but that's not derivative of the original. It's just we're still dealing with that bullshit.
Yeah.
It's still timely. So, I really love this movie.
It's a really, really fun movie. It's
so hard to get this tone right, and it
did. No, it's pretty much this movie and, to a somewhat more cynical degree, Psycho Goreman. Those are the two that I think of the last, 10 years... have done it very, very well.
I love Psycho Goreman.
I love it too, and I have high hopes for Deathstalker. That's coming out soon.
That's right. The makers of Psycho Goreman are remaking Deathstalker, which was a really cheap sword and sorcery fantasy epic made for $50 in, what was it, 86 or something?
Yeah. And MST3K finally got around to that one. Good episodes, because there was Deathstalker and Deathstalker 2.
There's four Deathstalker movies.
There were four Deathstalker movies.
I haven't seen the sequel.
That's so many Deathstalker movies. You'd think they would have stalked death by then.
They're just stalking death. They're not going to do anything. They're just sort of, stalking after.
Yeah, they certainly weren't caught stealing death.
Oh my god, that was the clumsiest.
Remember when we just used to yell the word Segway?
Segway!
Segway! Caught Stealing, the new Darren Aronofsky joint. is another movie that opened this last weekend. Toxic Avenger was more important. Literally. I genuinely believe that.
Toxic Avenger is great. Yeah, I mean, it's not playing in that many theaters, not that many cities. Mm. If it is nearby, really seek this one out. This is like, get some friends together. It's going to be a proper cult experience. I wait for movies like that.
Anyway, caught stealing. Darren Aronofsky is back. Or is he? Because until now, Darren Aronofsky has been on a one-man mission to punish his audiences. Have you noticed that? Almost every movie he makes is in some way, even if it's good, like a chore and very difficult and emotionally damaging.
Aggressive, oblique. He did make The Fountain, which is actually a very hopeful movie.
It's still very depressing, though.
Yeah, it's also about death. Yeah, he deals with like big things about, you know, death and torture. Mm-hmm. He's a very religious filmmaker. He's made a couple biblical epics.
He made one biblical epic. It was called Noah.
Well, he also did Mother, which is an Old Testament creation story.
I hesitate to call it biblical epic. It takes place in a house.
I suppose it's not an epic, but it is the Adam and Eve story.
It's a biblical film. I will give you that, even if it's being a bit coy about it. Hmm. But no, it's a religious film, 100%. Okay. Noah is like a $100 million epic.
Yeah.
Mother is Jennifer Lawrence upset about visitors to her house. Different aesthetic.
Yeah, but you're tearing
scale.
Your hair out because it's such a stressful film.
No, it's a very stressful movie.
I love Mother.
I see why you love Mother.
I'm actually very fond of Darren Aronofsky generally, although he just fell flat on his face when he made The Whale.
I hate The Whale.
The Whale is completely misguided. It's supposed to be, it's even in the script, it's a film about religious persecution, homophobia, and depression.
Yeah.
And how those things are just sort of eating away at the main character.
Yeah.
And Darren Aronofsky seems to think it's about obesity.
Yeah.
Like, it's specifically about his weight gain and his eating habits. It's like, no, those are details, but that's not what his life is about.
No,
his life is about his depression and the religious extremists and fundamentalists around him that sort of forced him and his boyfriend to just sort of fall down this pit of despair.
Yeah. It's a movie that is allegedly sympathetic, but Darren Aronofsky's, I don't know if it's his conscious or subconscious views on obesity or if it's... But my point is this. Visually, the presentation is disgusted by fat people in a way that genuinely, as I'm watching it, it's not that I'm offended. Mm. It's that my feelings are hurt. Mm. Like, I feel that you genuinely don't like me.
Yeah.
Is the vibe. And that you want a medal for finding a humanity in one of us. Mm. And I want you to seriously go fuck yourself. I don't know if I'll ever forgive him for that movie. Does it mean he's incapable of making good movies? Mm. No, I kind of like God Stealing. The Whale pissed me off. And I realized as I was watching The Whale that, while I respect a lot of Darren Aronofsky's movies, there's only one or two I actually like.
Oh, okay.
Like,
which two?
Pi.
Yeah.
Pi is a very good, very interesting, low-budget sci-fi movie. I think it does a whole lot with very little, full of big ideas. Mm. It's a very interesting film. I'm also very fond of how absolutely off the rails Noah is.
Yeah, Noah's pretty great.
Noah is bazonkers, and we do not talk about that enough. But a lot of his other movies, even the ones that people celebrate, like, I get it. I think there's good stuff in it. I think there's excellent stuff in Requiem for a Dream. But I think, and as much as, you know, you could throw this on Hubert Selby Jr., it's an almost absurd, no, not even almost, it is an absurdly blunt movie. To a point where it's like, no, I get it, you're making a point. You're not wrong. But also, come on. You don't have to put us through that. I get it. But stop. And even Black Swan, which is a lot that I respect, I find it annoyingly derivative. I feel like he's not actually adding much to a lot of his influences. And I think he leans so heavily on... I mean, Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis make that movie for me, not Darren Aronofsky.
Okay.
I think the performances are what really make that movie work. So, and I think Mother is maybe the most effective realization of what a panic attack feels like.
Yeah.
That I've ever seen in a movie. I don't enjoy watching it.
That's why I like it.
I don't like it, but it is effective. Mm. And I think that's a distinction we can make. Caught Stealing is a fun 1990s-esque post-Tarantino crime comedy.
It's
totally different.
It's well out of his wheelhouse. I think The Whale did win Brendan Fraser, the lead actor, an Academy Award.
It also won Best Makeup.
And Best Makeup.
Which is a shame, because the makeup was actually bad in that movie, mm-hmm. but anyway.
And I feel like he realized that he was off base with that one.
I hope so. I don't know where you're getting that
from. I'm getting that from Caught Stealing. Caught Stealing is him taking a Soderbergh turn in that he is trying a new genre. And he's trying an entirely new tone. He's trying to do kind of a little bit more of just a regular mainstream movie, because maybe something about The Whale made him lose his taste for that kind of a story.
See, I think that's interesting because to me, what you're describing, let's assume for a moment that that is true, and we're reading a lot into it, to be fair. We're invited we're invited to, it's art. Just for the record, we don't know. But we're making assumptions based on the text. Mm. If that's the case, I feel like that's more about him and it's more about him than it is the audience. Mm. And that's why that turn doesn't impress me.
Well, because that's not what about I'm cutting saying. The it's slack. About him.
It is about him. Exactly my point. It's just about, I want to do something different. And I'm like, no, I want you to reckon with what you did to us. That's the thing. I say, I don't really see this as being
It's not an apology. It's just sort of like, you know what? I did this thing. I started reading criticism of it. I'm going to do something really safe now. If he had moved on to something really kind of complex and difficult, The Whale would seem like a part of it. And now he's trying to kind of distance himself from a lot of his earlier filmography. I'd be interested to see if he does other kind of lightweight genre pictures. The script...
He's starting an AI studio.
He can do what he wants.
Technically, he can. I do not have to approve.
Yeah. that's his business.
Well, it's our business, too.
And if he makes a piece of shit out of AI, then I'm going to tell him he made a piece of shit with AI. The script for Caught Stealing feels like somebody fished it out of a drawer that had been there since 1994. Mm-hmm. The script is actually really cliche. It's really derivative.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of wit to it. There's not a lot of complexity to the characters. Mm-hmm. They're pretty straightforward, off-the-rack archetypes. Mm-hmm. What Darren Aronofsky brings to it is a good sense of pacing and a good sense of atmosphere, and he directs his actors very well.
He does.
I feel like Austin Butler is the star of this movie as a transplant to New York from San Francisco. He's going to remind you of this because he's a huge fan of the San Francisco Giants.
This will be mentioned in every scene that he is in.
Yeah.
Not just because he's wearing the hat.
And it does become a plot point very similarly to a plot point in Highest to Lowest.
I thought that
enough.
Was weird, yeah. right?
Like I've seen.
There's like a foot chase through New York and it ends up getting like outside a baseball stadium. Mm-hmm. And they use the baseball fans to distract people.
Exactly what happened in Highest to Lowest.
I'm sure that's a coincidence, but it's a hell of a coincidence that they came out so close to each other.
That Spike Lee and Darren Aronofsky should write the same scene.
Yeah.
They're not consulting with one another.
The plot of the movie is, though, he used to be a professional baseball hopeful. People thought he was going to go big.
Back in high school.
Yeah, he was in a car accident, and he messed up his knee, and now that's gone, and now he's just working as a bartender. All he does all day is drink and have sex with Zoe Kravitz. Oh, you poor man.
What a hard life he has.
What a hard fucking life.
And he looks like Austin Butler.
And
you
look
like
Austin Butler. They don't even like make him look like unkempt. He's just like, no, just super fucking handsome.
They just make him dazzling. And the camera loves that guy.
Oh my God.
Well, and Zoe Kravitz too.
These are all very pretty people. Man. The plot kicks in when they go up to his apartment one night and his next door neighbor, played by Matt Smith from Doctor Who,
As a British punker with a big mohawk.
Yeah.
It's set in 1998, by the way.
That's very important, which is the year Pi came out, if memory serves. So kind of all coming full circle.
97, 98, around there.
But anyway, Matt Smith says, listen, I have to go back home to England for a couple of days. A family member is sick. I need you to take care of my cat. Mm. And Austin Butler says, yeah, okay. And so... He's going to take care of his cat.
He says, no, I don't want to do that. But then, he kind of foists the cat on him anyway.
Well, I will appreciate this. And this is one of those, this is another save the cat kind of situation. He doesn't want the cat. He will die for that cat.
By the end of the movie.
Yeah. He will absolutely risk his life for that cat. That cat matters. And I appreciate that. And that that is Save the Cat in action right there. Just the whole damn movie. Anyway, long story short, a series of goons keep showing up to Matt Smith's apartment, and they're like, doors are right next to each other, and Austin Butler keeps kind of interacting with them, and they start kicking the crap out of him. They beat him up so bad he loses a kidney.
Early in the movie, too.
Yeah, first act. And then the rest of the movie, he's like sprinting through New York and like dropping off of buildings and stuff like that. And I'm like, who the fuck put those sutures together? They are a wunderkind.
Well, and there's even a scene partway through the movie where some goons hold him down to torture him and start pulling the staples out of his wound.
Yeah.
It's like, well, they do get that fixed. They kind of explain why. So it's going to leave a... Somebody says, this is going to leave a nasty scar, and they fix it.
Yeah.
So...
The kidney operation is going to leave a scar anyway.
That's the hand wave, but the fact that he's still kind of sprinting, and they even say at one point, you can't drink, and then he gets drunk later in the movie.
Yeah, he's going to die.
He's a bit of a scoundrel. He's depressed. I appreciate how rich they made the character. For a movie like this, because he's clearly a good guy, and there was always the sense that he's being forced in over his head. Like,
right.
What I really appreciate this about Caught Stealing, he makes good decisions, but it still fucks him over.
He mostly makes good decisions. He gets blackout drunk and forgets where he puts an important plot point in the middle of the movie.
That's
not all good decisions.
That's not a good decision, but like some goons come to his apartment and they beat him up. And what's the first thing he does? He calls the cops. He tells people about it. It's not one of those thrillers where... Because I get so frustrated with so many of these Hitchcock-derived thrillers where it's just the man on the run.
Yeah.
And they always have a line of dialogue along the lines of, well, I can't tell the cops, it'll get me in trouble, or I'm moving too quickly, I can't stop to tell anybody. No, you tell someone, you get help.
You tell someone you get help, yes. You don't call the cops, I'm sorry, yeah. I get it. The line of dialogue is, well, why don't we call the cops? Because they're the cops. Have you watched the news?
And
no.
Given how bad the goons are, like, the cops are almost the preferable option.
Granted.
And of course, there's going to be a subplot about corrupt cops.
And it doesn't always go great.
The goons we meet at first are, like, part of, like, perhaps the Ukrainian mob, but they don't know at first.
Yeah.
But they're also going to eventually run afoul of the Hasidic mob, which is a very 90s twist.
And seems to relate to his movie Pie as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was an undercurrent of... there was a conspiracy involving keeping a mathematical secret from the Torah out of capitalist hands.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Darren Aronofsky is not terribly religious. You can see that he's exploring his Judaism through his movies, like in subtle ways. Mm. Sometimes very obviously.
This
like
is not a subtle way. There are these two criminals who are very, very Jewish. And it's like, listen, we have to go kill these guys. But first, we have to go see our mother, Carol Kane, because she's made matzah soup and we don't want to offend her. And so you got to come with us. Okay.
These two characters, they're brothers. One of them is a rabbi. And Liev Schreiber and Vincent D'Onofrio, who are just great actors.
They're great.
So they're just going to bring it.
Great in everything.
There's nothing really novel in Caught Stealing. I've seen this in all kinds of crime movies.
Yes.
The way he gets in trouble, the way he hoodwinks things, the trauma he's suffering through his past, his relationship with his girlfriend. Some shocking twists I didn't quite see coming here and there.
One or two, yeah.
Nothing that like rewrote the script or anything.
I didn't think that character was going to do that.
Yeah, I didn't expect the movie to go quite there. All of this is stuff I've seen before.
Yeah.
But it's just happens to be done exceptionally well. I actually enjoyed watching it. Mm-hmm. I was engaged throughout the entire thing. I liked all of the characters. This is the way you're supposed to make a movie like this. Attention to detail, appealing characters, and a plot that I can follow.
Yeah.
And it does all of that to a T.
Yeah, I think you liked it a little more than I did, but I do think it mostly works. It is a fun, energetic... crime comedy, occasionally very, very dark, but it always springs back from it. I think it's incredibly well filmed. There's this one shot of like Austin Butler has to like some bad guys are in an apartment. Austin Butler has to climb out onto a fire escape, and I've never seen that shot. I've seen people climb out of fire escapes a billion times in movies. I've never seen anyone film it with that shot. And it just makes you feel like so small in the New York skyline. Yeah, like it really works.
There's a drone shot in
It looks really good. I don't think it amounts to much. I don't think it's trying to amount to much, but
it's trying to be slight.
It's trying to be slight, but I think its idea of the appeal of this is maybe a little simplistic. Austin Butler's boss at the bar is played by Griffin Dunn. I don't think that's a coincidence. Griffin Dunn starred in After Hours.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
After Hours is Martin Scorsese, one of Martin Scorsese's dark comedies that nobody appreciated at the time and everyone thinks is a classic now. They're right, but they should have appreciated it at the time. Griffin Dunn played a guy who calls a girl up in the middle of the night, goes across town to get laid. It doesn't work out, and he ends up just sort of wandering the streets, getting into one sick joke after another. And by the end of the movie, everyone in New York is like running after him, trying to kill him. He has just completely had the worst night of ever. It's a sick joke film. It is someone having the worst day of their life. I'm a sucker for that kind of a movie. But that movie has an energy, and it also has Scorsese's like Catholic cautionary tale mentality, where it does feel like the filmmaker is punishing the protagonist, whether it's fair or not. There are rules and you broke them. And I feel like Darren Aronofsky doesn't even have that level of point of view. I think he's just doing stuff to do it. Is that the end of the world? No, it's a slight crime comedy. Could it have benefited from a stronger point of view? Yeah, I think that's fair. But I like this Darren Aronofsky. I'm not convinced it's the same Darren Aronofsky. I was watching this and I was like, is this Darren W.S. Aronofsky? Are there two Darren Aronofskys? Like we have two Paul Andersons and like we have to like start making a distinction? Because this doesn't feel like Darren Aronofsky.
It's so different from not just his body of work, but specifically from the last one he just made.
That's coupling.
Like he is clearly attempting something new. He's trying to turn a corner in some way. I don't know if this is him trying to atone for The Whale, if you read the criticisms of The Whale.
I'm not sure I buy that. I'd like to think that, but I'm not sure I buy that. I think he's just bored, honestly. I think he's just been making the same type of drama, whether it's a realistic or fantasy or whatever, for so long that I think he just kind of burned out and wanted to do something different. Great, honestly, because frankly, I find his work hit or miss and mostly miss. So I'm always done with like zeal, always done with a lot of talent, but I think ultimately his stories aren't necessarily as ingenious as he seems to think they are, or at the very least, I think he's got some weird ideas that undermine them. Here, it's a shallow crime comedy.
It's a good one,
but it's a good one. Yeah, it does what it sets out to do. It doesn't completely fuck it up.
No,
the way The Whale did. It doesn't. It's not like so oppressive that it's hard to watch. It's a genuinely entertaining movie. I don't love it, but it's one of the very few Darren Aronofsky movies I consider to be likable, and I'll applaud him for that. Seriously, good. This is a good change of pace. I don't know if you're just getting it out of your system or you really want to do a big turn in your career, but kudos regardless.
Well, I'm interested to see where he goes next. Is he going to go back to heady panic trip kind of movies, or is he going to continue with crowd pleasers like this?
No idea. Well, I mean, crowd pleaser, let's be fair here. This is like the kind of movie that would have been a modest hit in 1997 and it barely made a dent today. I don't know if the audiences are like... Crowd pleaser would be him doing like a franchise movie. I feel like this is just him trying to make a genre film.
Crowd pleaser, and it's just a mainstream entertainment is my point.
I guess my point is I don't really see this as being all that mainstream by today's standards. By today's standards, it's a little niche.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
What was the last crime comedy of this ilk that made a splash?
Can't think of one off the top of my head. But yeah.
That's my point. And that doesn't mean people don't like them.
Yeah.
I just don't think that this is all that mainstream anymore. I think this is also a bit niche. It's just more fun. I don't know. I think people are probably going to discover it on home video. It's kind of tanking in theaters and they're going to enjoy it. And I think it'll probably get good word of mouth overall.
Yeah.
But probably. In theaters, I think this is a pretty tough sell because it doesn't really feel like something you have to go see. It looks slight. That's not my job. Okay. I don't care. I'm just making a point. I just think right. I don't think crowds are going to be especially pleased because crowds aren't going. Give them time. All right. Got two more movies. I saw them. You didn't. I'll try to make it quick.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
The next film is The Roses, directed by Jay Roach. It is a remake of The War of the Roses.
Wasn't it a play at first?
It was a novel at first.
A novel, okay.
Yeah, there was a novel. The title is a cheeky historical reference, but it's actually about
it's
a married couple.
It's not about the actual War of the Roses.
No, it's about a married couple whose last name is Rose. In the original film, Danny DeVito directed it and played a divorce lawyer. Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner, they got married. Their marriage hit the skids. And towards the end of it all boiled down to they want to get a divorce, but neither of them wants to give up the house. So they start being more and more cruel to each other to try to get them to want to leave of their own accord until it starts turning more and more dark and more violent. It's a very, very bleak comedy about marriage and divorce. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember the first time I watched it and I was like, I didn't know comedies could get this dark.
And that's Danny DeVito's thing. He tends to go a little bit bleak when he makes his movies.
100%. And, I haven't seen it in a while. I remember it being one of his best movies. The remake stars Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman. Good cast. Holy shit. I will watch. You're telling me they're in it? I'll watch it. You're telling me they're married and they're going to banter a lot? I'm in. he's a famous architect. She is a chef. Not very famous. But he's doing very, very well. In the beginning of the movie, he buys her a little restaurant. And she only keeps it open a couple of days a week. It's basically her hobby.
Okay.
More than anything else. She doesn't even need to make money on it. At the beginning, they also have two kids. At the beginning of the movie, there is a hurricane. A freak hurricane off the California coastline. It demolishes his biggest architectural project. And he can't get any work after that. It was like not built to withstand that kind of weather. Global warming fucked him. His career is destroyed. But on that same night, because there was a hurricane, everyone stopped at her restaurant. And also, who was there? A food critic who thought her work was remarkable, gave her an incredible review, and now she's successful and famous, and he's not.
And this is what drives a wedge between
them. This is what drives a wedge between. Initially, it seems like something they might be able to work towards, but it's a seed that just keeps growing and growing and growing into a very poisonous plant. It's not just that his career has fallen apart. His entire sense of self is destroyed. And she doesn't know how to talk to him about that. So she just decides not to.
Okay.
And so he decides, they decide he's going to stay home and take care of the kids for a while. And she's going to focus on work for a while. Gradually, she starts focusing on work more and more and more. And neglecting him and the kids. And gradually, he starts focusing more on the kids and neglecting her more and more and more and resenting the amount of time they spend apart. The movie takes place over quite a few years.
Okay, that's what I was going to say.
This is a long gestating seed of hatred that grows. And they don't even realize it. The best running gag in the movie is that everyone in the... Because it takes place in California. They're British. Everyone that they know mistakes their absolutely obvious hatred for one another as, oh, they're British.
Just Britishism.
This is just British people like to snipe. We've seen movies.
Nah.
Maggie Smith in everything. Like, we get it. This is just how you are. But secretly, you love each other. And even they seem confused by that. There's a bit where they go to a marriage counselor, and the marriage counselor said, I want you to write down five things you like about your wife and your husband. And they end up writing five things that they absolutely detest about them, where they find a way, like, sometimes I don't imagine caving your head in with an axe. And they're laughing, and the marriage counselor is like, you guys should not be married. You have an enormous amount of resentment and you're barely hiding it. And you think it's funny. This is actually just genuine negative emotions. And you're going to hurt yourself and you're going to hurt your kids. And they go, Americans, what do they know? And they decide to stay married for another 8 years. And you're just like, oh, no. Jay Roach is...
How do the kids play into this?
The kids are interesting because initially when she's at home with the kids... She wants them to be very free-spirited. She always makes them lots of cakes. She just wants them to enjoy childhood, enjoy life. Mm. When she goes to work, Benedict Cumberbatch decides to take over, and he makes them into fitness nuts.
Okay.
So that they're, like, jogging around. But here's the thing. They actually like it.
Okay.
They're actually really into it, and they become, really...
kind of a good dad.
It's kind of a good dad. He's not... kind of, it's more like happenstance that they happen to be into the thing he kind of forced them to do.
Okay.
But they are, and unfortunately, this just makes Olivia Colman feel that much more detached from her kids. Because she didn't really have any say in that, and now they are all into something that she doesn't enjoy.
How is this a comedy film?
That's the thing.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, Jay Roach is taking an interesting tonal approach to this movie, where he really wants you to feel like this marriage could be saved. It's just... at some point they're going to talk and they're really going to have it out and they're going to realize they still care about each other and they're hurt by each other and they don't understand how to communicate.
Okay.
But some shit always goes down and it's always miserable and it's fate. It's a very dark comedy about life not working out the way you want to. And they're being very, very snippy. For example, there's a part where Olivia Colman comes home from work after like disappearing for a weekend and she was like, oh, do you want to have sex? No. Benedict Cumberbatch says, but how would you like a 3-hour circular argument that leads nowhere? And that's a very funny line.
That's cute.
It's that kind of repartee. But over the course of the film, it gets darker and darker and darker until they're actually thinking of killing each other. The problem is, and here's the thing, Jay Roach is actually doing a pretty good job of nailing that tone, where it's a comedy, but it's also a romantic tragedy. He surrounds them with a couple of comedy actors. Andy Samberg plays Benedict Cumberbatch's best friend. He's a lawyer. Mm. He's playing it pretty straight, actually. Like, he's kind of got a dry humor, but he's not doing shtick.
Okay.
He's giving, like, a genuine performance, very grounded in the world of the film. Playing his wife is Kate McKinnon, and I do not know what Jay Roach told her on set.
Probably just do whatever you want.
And he should not have told her that. Because I love Kate McKinnon. I think she's very funny.
Uh-huh.
She's not in the same movie as everyone else. Hmm. She is in a very broad comedy where she's... The gag is that she's not terribly happy with Andy Samberg and he's not terribly happy, but they've decided to just sort of live with that.
Okay.
But she's under the table. She's very flirty with Benedict Cumberbatch and it's abundantly clear that if he wanted to, they could have a fling.
Hmm.
Now, that absolutely fits in with the narrative that we're talking about here. It reflects the strife in their own marriage. It makes them confront the possibility of, like, do you even want to risk this marriage? But she's playing it so fucking broad. Like, she's humping his leg at a dinner party. And it's like, that's not the movie. We're not in that movie. That's a very silly version of this. Maybe that could have worked. That's not the movie. So every time she's on screen, the entire movie falls apart, which is a shame because, again, I think she's really talented. I can only assume there was some miscommunication or Jay Roach thought that would be a good idea and that was a miscalculation. But it all ends in a very, very dark fashion. And I will admit the actual ending is deliciously bleak.
Okay.
It's a very, very dark comedy. Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman are so good in it that if this isn't the kind of thing that would depress you because, you know, it's about a marriage and divorce, it's really just going absolutely miserable, they're worth watching. They're very funny in it. They're doing good work.
Mm.
As a movie, it's just okay.
Okay.
Because Jay Roach kind of lets some of it get away from him.
Well, Jay Roach is, like, he did Austin Powers and Mystery Alaska. Like, he's a mainstream comedy guy.
Mystery Alaska is a pretty grounded comedy compared to Austin Powers. Okay. People forget that. It's more of a slapshot kind of thing.
Okay.
Pretty good movie, actually. But yeah, no, Jay Roach, he's his thing is broad comedies. That's what he's best known for.
Like, he does broad comedies. He doesn't have a huge amount of personality as a director. Mm-hmm. Like, you couldn't necessarily
peg a
Jay Roach film, you know, just by its style.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So, what is he doing here? Well, like, how is he trying to make this into a mainstream comedy?
I think he's been trying in the last, 10 years, I guess, to sort of reframe himself as a serious filmmaker who happens to be funny. He directed Trumbo with Bryan Cranston, which was okay, but Bryan Cranston was really good in it. Mm. He directed Bombshell, the movie about what was going on behind the scenes.
That was
Fox.
Jay Roach?
That was Jay Roach.
Oh, gosh.
And that's another movie that is just okay, but there's some good performances in it. The Roses is just okay, but there's some good performances in it. I guess that's what he does now.
Yeah.
Like, on the surface, it looks like a really good movie, but it's not quite. Mm. But the actors are really pulling it through. I was watching The Roses and I was thinking to myself, this was designed to fill out the ballot at the Golden Globes comedy section. Like, it's not going to get any Oscars traction. I'd be shocked if it did. But
so it's a comedy
film,
but it's meant to be kind of a dramedy.
Yeah, this
awards big
like,
movie.
Coleman and Cumberbatch are probably going to be nominated for Golden Globes.
Okay.
Will they be nominated for Oscars? No. I would be shocked.
It's a bit of a cynical way to think about it, but
it does. Sometimes it just feels like, who is this for?
Mm.
I mean, it's not a crowd pleaser. It's a crowd embitterer. and you know, there's a pleasure in that. Don't get me wrong. But yeah, no, it feels like he makes movies in an attempt to not tell a great story or great cinema, but to impress people enough that they'll give him kudos, you know, that they'll be nominated for things. I mean, I don't mean to put words in his mouth. I don't know what he actually thinks, but those are the movies he makes.
Mm.
You know, the movies that get a few nominations here or there and maybe wins best makeup and then we're done. And the Bombshell didn't make an impact.
It's a bit of a
Trumbo
cynical way
impact.
To look at it, but all right.
No,
yeah.
It's a cynical approach to filmmaking, I think. And I think this movie comes very, very close to maybe not greatness, but to really, really working. And then there's just that one element where it's just like, why? Why did we do that? Why did we... Damn shame. Anyway, last movie is a little movie that happens to be very big. It is called The Thursday Murder Club. The Thursday Murder Club.
It's based on a book series.
It's based on a book. I don't know if it's a whole... I don't know if it's a series yet. I know that it's intended to be a series. I don't know if the second book ever actually came out. Hold on. It's worth checking, I guess. Looks like there are multiple books already. They're books. They were written by Richard Osman, who was actually quite a celebrity in Britain before he even wrote a book. So, you know, good leg up on that situation. It's in the cozy crime vein. It is about a group of retirees who live at, frankly, the fanciest retirement home I've ever seen in a film. It is a beautiful castle. Everyone has, like, not only do they have their own room, but their room is the size of my apartment, which is generally not how big those are. And they all have very different aesthetics. Like, one of them looks like the interior of, like, an Oxford college professor's office. Another one looks like a man cave. Like, I'm just like... But, like, the wood has different aspects. Like, I don't know who the fuck designed this house. But anyway. Everyone at this retirement home is busying themselves in some way. They have art classes. They can hang out with llamas. They just have those. There's embroidery. And a handful of them, Helen Mirren, Ben Kingsley, and Pierce Brosnan, are in a Thursday murder club where every Thursday they meet and try to solve a real murder, usually a cold case.
Okay.
Apparently, it was started by someone who was at the retirement home who used to be a cop.
All right.
That person is now currently in a coma, and they're just going on without her. Joining their ranks is a new person at the retirement home, played by Celia Imrie. And they find her particularly useful because she used to be a nurse. So she can answer questions like, would this stab wound necessarily have killed somebody? Yeah. Or might there be another cause of death? That kind of thing. And while they are trying to solve their latest murder, David Tennant shows up. He owns the land that they live on. And he wants to kick them out. But he can't do it because the other guy who owns the place, they co-own it, is kind of standing in the way. And then that guy ends up dead.
Ooh.
So now they have to solve a new murder, fresh murder.
Real murder.
A delicious murder. Delectable murder. that's it. That's the movie. They're gonna be cute. Mm-hmm. They're going to solve that murder. One or two of them are going to have a bit more of a badass background than you might have expected. That's it. That's the movie. If you've seen a cozy murder mystery, you've seen this. Now, it's my understanding, based on the people I've talked to or have messaged me after I put my review on Blue Sky, I didn't write this one up in print, that the book is actually very witty.
Okay.
And maybe atypical of the genre. You wouldn't know it from watching this movie. Chris Columbus has turned this into an incredibly generic film. Mm-hmm. More expensive, sure, with a bigger cast than you'd normally get. That's for goddamn sure. Helen Mirren, Pierce Brosnan, Ben Kingsley, Celia Emery. These are
the big
these
names,
are big actors,
yeah.
You know. We got Jonathan Pryce is in this as well. Paul Freeman. I won't reveal it, but there's another big actor who shows up towards the end. It's like a cameo, extended cameo. It's all full of big gets. But as I'm watching this movie and I'm thinking to myself, this is fine.
Mm.
I'm also thinking to myself, you got this gigantic cast, a director who's directed some of the biggest movies of all time. You know, he did Home Alone, he did the first two Harry Potters. And you clearly threw money at it. And what you achieved was not significantly better than anything you'd see on Hallmark that cost $100,000.
It's so odd when big directors kind of have to downscale in that way.
You know, I don't know if that's the case, though. And here's what I was thinking about. I think that the cozy mystery defies any attempt to make it huge. Mm. Because otherwise it's not cozy, is it?
Well,
it's got to be comforting and relaxing and make you want to hang out with these characters. Mm. If they start doing things that are hugely cinematic, it ceases to be what it is.
Well, you can do things that are cinematic in a cozy fashion.
Mm.
Production design, you know, the cast, for instance. I'm sure they cost a lot.
That's my point. You put production design and a cast in there. But the actual narrative and tone that they're going for doesn't need any of that.
Hmm.
You don't need a big cast. Helen Mirren isn't going to elevate this material because it can't be elevated. It's just whimsy.
Mm.
That's not to say Helen Mirren isn't great. She's great in everything. But
is it effective whimsy? Is my point. There's right and wrong ways to do
that. Oh, there's absolutely right and wrong ways to do that. And you know, and it's adequate whimsy. It's adequate whimsy. Mm. Like, if you were to ask me... Hallmark did a couple of movies based on the Murder, She Baked series, which was about a woman who lives in a small town. She runs a bakery, and people die in her small town, and she happens to get involved and solve mysteries. Somehow baking is part of the plot. Also, the books are great because every recipe that she cooks, they also include the recipe.
Yeah.
So you can make the recipe yourself. Very, very fun. We made a couple of those, two or three, maybe even four. If you were to ask me, which is better, the Thursday Murder Club, which had this huge cast and put a lot of money in production design and stuff, or the first Murder, She Baked, which clearly cost 1/100th of that budget, I would say they're the same in terms of overall entertainment value. It's just that comfy and disposable.
Mm.
And that's not bad. That's not a bad thing to be. It's just, if you try to goose this up, it's still the same goose. Like, you're just... It defies the superstar treatment. The reason why the Agatha Christie adaptations pulled this off. Because you'll remember stuff like Murder on the Orient Express or Death on the Nile, not even Kenneth Branagh's versions, the originals as well. Mm-hmm. They brought in an all-star cast. The reason why that worked is because every member of the cast, except for Poirot or Miss Marple or whoever, was a suspect. Mm. So oftentimes in a murder mystery movie, you'd say to yourself, well, that guy is played by an inexplicably big actor, so I'm constantly looking at him because I figure you can't get that guy unless he's got a good role. Mm. So probably him? Like, it just kind of gives the game away. But if every actor is huge, anyone could have done it.
Right.
That's the appeal. And so everyone gets something juicy. Everyone gets to be the suspect. Everyone possibly is the killer. And the audience feels like they're really getting their money's worth out of these actors because we're really staring at them. Mm. In a cozy mystery like this, all the big stars are the heroes.
Yeah, they're the detectives.
Yeah, and that's cute.
It's like only Murders in the Building. They have the three leads. They're the celebrities, and they're also the detectives.
Yeah. But you're not getting as much out of that star power if you've got a big ensemble cast of great actors whose only thing is to be like, yes, that is a clue, isn't it? Oh, we should make another cake. Like, that's cute.
I mean, is the mystery at least interesting?
It's like, fine.
Like, does it surprise you?
Not really. Right. I mean, it's fine.
All right.
You know, like, I've read and watched a lot of mysteries. It takes a bit to really blow me away with the solution to the mystery. Like, I'm usually. But here's the thing: a good murder mystery, or really just any murder mystery that's like leaning into it, It's in a game with the audience.
Yeah.
Like, it's toying with you. It wants you to try to solve it. Hopefully, the movie beats you, and it happens, and it's satisfying, but it's something that you didn't predict turns out to be correct. But also, if you predict it correctly, you're still playing the game. Like, you're not, like, beating the movie. You're just playing, and you won.
Yeah.
This is just, you know, it's fine. There's a bit towards the middle where it's like, oh, it's probably that guy. And then you check the timestamp and you're like, oh, it's not that guy. There's no way it's that guy because
they would reveal it this early.
Reveal it this early. Maybe they'd reveal like later on that his alibi was bullshit, but usually not. Mm. Or maybe or they could only do that one time, maybe.
Right.
And it's just sort of like, oh, yeah, no. So it's fine. That's the thing. It's fine. It's the kind of movie that's specifically designed for you to watch with your parents.
Yeah.
Because everyone can agree on it and no one will be offended and everyone will have a reasonably okay time.
Yeah.
But to treat this like a giant project didn't make it any better. Maybe someone's going to watch it because there's a big cast and they wouldn't otherwise. I guess that's something to it, but it doesn't make the movie better.
Hmm.
It just makes the movie slightly more marketable because there are more heads on the thumbnail. And it's just sort of fine. Yeah. Anyway, let's review some movies on the movie review roundup.
I wanted to see it just because it looks cute.
It's cute. It's a little too long, but it's fine.
I know the cozy mystery is like a bit of a bowdlerization of what Agatha Christie was doing.
With Miss Marple in particular, yeah.
And if you know anything about what Agatha Christie thought about her own movies, she tended to hate them because of the movies.
Yeah.
Like most adaptations, TV movies, even ones she was involved with, she didn't like because the filmmakers tended to make them cozy or whimsical or silly or comedic in some way. She's gone on record saying, you know, oh, I love this actress, but that's not my Miss Marple.
Sure.
So it's... The cozy mystery is sort of like this weird derivation of Agatha Christie that I think she never wanted to see happen.
No, and I think it's fair to say that Agatha Christie didn't really write them, although certainly Miss Marple is a progenitor.
Yeah.
Like, you can see a clear through line. It's like, what's the word? Psycho is not a slasher.
Yeah.
But it clearly inspired what would become the slasher. Mm. Like, over the next 15 years, it evolved into Halloween. And then that particular genre was codified.
Yeah.
But you can definitely see that it came from this.
Mm.
The cozy mystery, I have a great fondness for cozy mysteries. I think they can be really, really delightful. They're easy reads. And really, they're cozy not because, you know, they're cute. They're cozy because they're reassuring.
Mm.
They're cozy because you want to live in that small town or you want to have tea with that mystery solver. You know, it's It's in many ways, it is sort of like Hallmark in general. Like, you know, the whole thing with like, yeah, you moved to the big city to focus on work, and now you've kind of lost touch with, like, you know, family values and Christmas or whatever, and then you realize, oh, that was nice. And that's the kind of thing with the murder mystery in the cozy genre. It's, you know, yeah, murder happens, that sucks, but yeah, everyone's pretty nice usually, you know, deep down, you know, and so really, you know, these things happen, and it's bad, and we'll stop that, but... And I want to pet my cat. Like, that's just kind of, you know.
Yeah.
And that's nice. I find nothing wrong with reassuring cinema, reassuring TV, reassuring books. But I think you should acknowledge what that is.
Yeah.
And I think a movie like The Thursday Murder Club is doing that. But I think they've tricked themselves into thinking that this is more than that.
Yeah.
Just because it's got a big cast. Just because it's got a big budget. And it's not. It's just the material is the material.
Mm.
You know? Like, I use this analogy online, but like, imagine if, you know, they made The Christmas Prince, that like Netflix movie about like an American who falls for a prince at Christmas.
Mm.
Hallmark-esque, just more expensive. But like, imagine if you did that, but you cast Daniel Day-Lewis and Jodie Foster and Sean Penn and whatever.
It's really intense actors.
It would still be The Christmas Prince. Mm. You didn't have to do that. They had better uses of their time. Like, you would have made the exact same movie and you wouldn't have like built up everyone's expectations for it to be something. And then Daniel Day-Lewis is like, yes, I didn't quite believe in Christmas and now I do. Great. Glad we got him. That's great. Like, we didn't need that. That didn't amount to much. Anyway, let's review movies. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+. C- is the lowest grade we give. Those are movies that we think are below average. We do not recommend them. A C is an average movie. These are movies that are just okay, mixed bag, solely for one audience. Most other people aren't going to dig it. And then a C+ is above average. These are movies that we genuinely recommend. We think they're really fun, really good, maybe even great. On that note, Thursday Murder Club, textbook C.
All right.
Just, boom, middle of the road. The cast is a little overqualified for this, but it's still what it is. And what it is competent.
Yeah.
And if that's all you want to see, you'll get it. And bully for you. The Roses. Another C.
All right.
It's a high C. I think the good mostly outweighs the bad. I think Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman carry the movie. It is their movie.
Mm.
But sometimes Jay Roach lets the movie get away from him, and it doesn't quite add up to as much as it should as a result. But if you like dark comedies and you like Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman, definitely worth checking out. Otherwise, take it or leave it. Caught Stealing.
That's it. I'm going to give it a C+. I think it's a pretty typical heist comedy, but I feel it just does it exceptionally well. Doesn't reinvent the wheel, but I like seeing it done as well as this.
Hey, we still use wheels. Right. Yeah, I'm going to give it a high C.
Okay.
I like it fine. It never... There's nothing wrong with being a slight crime comedy, but as I'm watching and I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to forget this existed. Like, this is... eventually, this is going to be that other movie Darren Aronofsky did.
Yeah.
And I'm going to... I like it fine, but I don't like it so much that I feel it is a confident recommendation. It's just... pretty good at this.
Okay.
But it's not bad. Not bad, that's for sure. So high C. And finally, The Toxic Avenger.
C+. I loved how gross and strange and... but also kind of sweet and earnest it was underneath its mutated skin.
No, I think Macon Blair gets this. I think he gets the material. I think he's assembled people who know what movie he's making.
Yeah.
I think it is... you're right. It's sweet and it's gross. It's innocent and it's cynical about the right things.
Yeah.
And I think that they clearly actually cared about and studied the trauma aesthetic and did a wonderful job recapturing it.
Yeah.
Kudos to them. Seriously. They didn't just make a good Toxic Avenger movie. They made an actual Toxic Avenger movie. Mm. And who would have thought?
In 2025.
Yeah.
Again, we can still do that.
It's not ironic. It's just a genuine toxie. And good for them. Big ol' C+. All right. That is it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. Feel free to send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Ask us questions, take us to task, correct us on something, whatever you want to do. World is your oyster. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter, if you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641-565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where you can get all of our episodes ad-free. You can get exclusive shows, especially our Star Trek series, where we review every Star Trek ever. Hundreds of episodes will open up to you like a flower of joy. But we also have a ton of other exclusive material on there. Whole series of podcasts that have like gone to completion that you can download at any time. Whitney has his various radio dramas.
That's right.
And also, even if you want to subscribe just for free, every week you do get a free newsletter with links to our latest work and original writing from Whitney and usually myself.
Yeah.
It's fun. So thank you to all of our patrons. We couldn't do this without you. We think you're the absolute best. We're on social media on Blue Sky, at William Bibbiani, at Whitney Seibold, at Critic Acclaimed.
Oh, all that, yeah. Yeah,
and that's it. Never forget, everyone is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?